Just wanted to mark out organized information in Twister form.
Well, the reason I wrote it this way is that if you calculate the computational ratios of J1 and J2, or J2 and J3, or J3 and J1, you get the angular dimension rules. Now, the point about these J's is that if you look at that formula, they're conformally invariant. They just depend on things and track it together. They all commute with the F alpha beta that generates the conformal transformations. So they can be considered to be internal symmetries. They preserve the structure. Action of the algorithm preserves all the structure that you've got. If you define auxiliary quantities, J plus and J minus, X, Z bar and Z X bar, you get the usual rules for raising and lowering operators of any okay. Now, this generates an SU2 internal symmetry group, or O3, SO3, depending on what you're doing. What about the rest of the internal symmetry? Well, it's been long known that the as Roger mentioned earlier, and later, the internal symmetry also has an inhomogeneous bit. How do you add that? How do you add the inhomogeneous bit to the J1s to get what you want? You add on the trace of F alpha beta, you add on D plus. You add on those two things, and those things together, if you work out their computational relations, they're just very simple, and they generate the neat algebra of the special Euclidean group that Roger was talking about earlier. Further, the F, being a component of F alpha beta, preserves the commutes with F alpha beta, so it's conformally invariant. The D plus and minus don't. They only preserve the kinematic, Poincaré kinematic structure, the A. Also, you have a formula that the mass square is given by twice D plus D minus, determined by the generators, two of the generators of the special Euclidean group. Yeah, I should mention that the geometric interpretation of the F operator as far as the Euclidean group goes, the F operator is the U1 part of the Euclidean group, just rotations in their plane about the origin. D plus and D minus represent the real imaginary parts of the D plus and D minus represent translations in the Euclidean 2 plane. Anyway, the remarkable thing, which was also pointed out earlier, is that the two Casimir operators of this group, the combined group of SU2 and SU2, they have two Casimir operators, and they also are Casimir operators of the Poincaré. This J squared was, if you remember, defined as the square root of the Casimir masses. So they have Casimir operators of the internal symmetry and of the external symmetry. And the next thing I want to do is describe the representation theory in this internal symmetry group. It's very elementary because the two groups commute with each other, the representation. So you basically go just look at SU2 and you push it around a bit with SU2 and see what you get. The result is that if you fix J and M, which is the Casimir operators, what you get is an infinite ladder of SU2 spin isospin J representation. The point is that SU2 is an internal symmetry. You think I was being talking about isospin. This is meant to be leptons, but this isn't actually isospin, weak spin or something. The SU2 generators have the same Casimir operator as the rotation part of the Rx group. So you're forced to call the spin of the particle also the isospin. You're forced to have, suppose you have a doublet, SU2, suppose you have a spin half lepton, then it's forced to come in a doublet. Because an SU2 internal isospin doublet, given the fact that it's external spin half, similarly from a spin three halves, we'd have to have it in a quartet. Ordinary spin half, spin three halves, isospin three halves quartet. Now, the simplest way to describe the representations is in terms of two diagonal operators, Z and X, which are just essentially homogeneity operators. They have the property that they are integrally quantized, and that the sum of them is the this F operator, and their difference is basically the J3 part of the triangle, the J3 eigenvalue. So that's where you can label the states by the eigenvalues of J squared, which of course are J into J plus 1, by the mass, just M, and we'll use little x, and little z, and the eigenvalues of the x and z operators. Then x and z are diagonal, the eigenvalues of x and z. J plus and J minus act as good choices.
Given by
an observation of Rogers. The question is, how do you sort of just describe the problem of what you've got to do with electrons? So Rogers says, well, what you do is draw a cube. I'm afraid it's rather badly drawn. And on it you stick electrons. And you do it in such a way that the whenever you have an interaction, well, let me remind you about leptons. There are eight of them that I'm worried about to begin with, and then we'll think about the heavy leptons and things later on. The eight known leptons are muon electrons, they're antiparticles, four, and four neutrinos, muon neutrino, electron neutrino, and they're antiparticles. So what we want to do is stick eight of them on. They also have three conserved quantum numbers, as far as people know. Until last year, when there was a rumor that some of these numbers weren't conserved, but there's always the charge. Nobody's yet found violated, even by the black hole, as a conservation number. Then you also have the total lepton number, and what you might call the electron number, E, which is basically measured in the electron content, or the muon number, M. Such that the electron number is one for both the neutrino, electron neutrino, and the electron, minus one for the antiparticle, and zero for everything else. And the muon number is one for the muon, one for the muon neutrino, minus one for the antiparticle, and zero for everything else. And you have the identity E plus M is equal to L. You've only got three, so that's one independent. Well, three conserved quantum numbers means that you can draw three-dimensional pictures of the next beam, and stick the electrons on a cube in such a way that the quantum numbers balance. So in any allowed interaction which conserves these four numbers, three independent ones, the center of gravity of the interaction will be at the origin. If you imagine, well, more precise, suppose you have the muon going to the electron, an anti-electron neutrino, and the muon neutrino, the center of gravity of the incoming system is at the same place as the center of gravity of the outgoing system. Or if you imagine turning this around, just put the mu plus here, let's have a vacuum there. These four particles have the quantum numbers of the vacuum, so I have mu plus there. And any allowed decay is one of the quantum numbers of the vacuum, and any such thing has center of gravity of the origin. Well, what I'm going to do is think of one circular things as being representing particles and square things as being antiparticles, having opposite quantum numbers. Let's think how we can put the how we can use this setup. I haven't committed myself to which color represents which electron. It's up to you if you choose. There are certain allowed possibilities. What we want to do is take this cube and we want to represent it on this lattice. Now there are various arguments. First, let's decide what constraints there are and what we do. The various arguments, remember the x and z properties down here, on the other end. The x and z are on the axis, and there are arguments that they should change some under particle antiparticle conjugation. So that means whenever I put a block, a circular block here, I have to put the square of the same color on the opposite side. Particle is there, antiparticle is there, particle, antiparticle, antiparticle, so on. The simplest possibility is to assume that the eight leptons occupy the first four rungs of the ladder, like this. Of course, I still have to commit myself to what the colors represent in terms of actual physics. So what are the possibilities? Well, let me just go through the three basic possibilities. The first one is this setup here. But what you can do is you can stick electron here, and the electron neutrino here, and the muon neutrino there, and then they had the particles at the bottom in the corresponding places, and that's represented by this scheme here. The red circle goes for muon, yellow for muon neutrino, green for electron, and what's mentioned blue, I think, for an electron neutrino. Now, there are various other possibilities. If you observe this pair groups the electron and the neutrino into an SU2 doubler. So this is the nearest thing we have to the Weinberg-Solano-Solano Weinberg theory. They have the left-handed part of these gadgets actually in an SU2 doubler. So if you're thinking that maybe their SU2 is the same as this one, this would be a natural thing to do. There are other possibilities, though, and also the muon and the muon neutrino also go down in the cross-section possibly. There are other possibilities. This one, for instance, you could put the two neutrinos on one side and keep the electron in the inside and put the muon there. That would be this possibility. And then the final one, this corresponds to having equal charge objects in the same SU2 multiple. Not the same as one goes along. And this one is more exotic still. It's again not the same. You've got an electron and an anti-muon neutrino, also in a doubler. Now, these are three basic possibilities. These essentially are basically all independent in the sense of possibility. There are various permutations which you're allowed, which transform one allowed scheme into another. What you can do is take the two colors green and blue and interchange with red and yellow simultaneously, or take the two colors blue and yellow and interchange simultaneously with green and red with any of these assignments. And you can also interchange red and yellow and yellow and red, and this again will be a possible assignment. The criterion being for possible assignment that any allowed interaction with a center mass zero here should also be allowed reaction center mass zero here. If there are no other ways of doing it than each of these permutations. Some of these permutations basically are a question of labeling which is the z-twist and which is the x-twist, so they're rather trivial. Some of the other ones are rather more subtle, and they're to do with things like the twisted transform. It's not very clear exactly what they mean. Okay, altogether there are 48 different schemes that you can come from. Now, that's the basic setup. We're not able to select one of these. The thing is that this doesn't work. If this had worked, at least in my opinion, it doesn't work. If this had worked, it doesn't obviously not work. But let's just point out one flaw in it, which is a rather simple thing. And that is that you actually have three conserved quantum numbers up here, and you have a three-dimensional picture reflecting the fact that they automatically conserve by the question of the center of gravity being the origin of the rule. But here we have a two-dimensional picture. So the three conserved quantum numbers somehow are not guaranteed by this diagram. In fact, it's possible to choose, supposing you settle on one of these assignments, it's possible to choose a selection of particles here, what they are, which balance in the sense that their center of gravity is indeed at the origin, but they represent a system of interactions which violates every conserved quantum number. Q, L, E, and M are all violated. So the hypothesis of balancing of center of gravity here doesn't reproduce the known interactions in a way that this hypothesis, this cubic picture, does. So there's another more serious difficulty about this, where it's not really a difficulty, it's just a failure of this model. One of the things that is nice to try and do in physics is to try and make predictions. Because basically, predictions, you get a guideline whether what you're doing is somehow approximating reality. And as it is at the moment, I don't know if you notice, there's a distinct absence of anything to do with experiment, except possibly James Thorpe, where he was actually talking about real particles, but without any substantial claim that that they really were the same. I mean, it looks like it. They very much look like the hadrons can be described by Newton and Crystal. Now, what you need is some kind of experimental hope, that's some kind of experimental result, which is going to encourage you that you're going to get you're on the right track. There are two places you can look, either the leptons, the three, or the hadrons of the charge particle. It does look that there may be a role for even the three-twist of hadron model to get any well charm, particularly in the context of what's called baryonium. Recently, in the last couple of years, people have found these states which look like they don't belong to the ordinary familiar SU3 representation. They correspond to maybe four quark states. More complicated SU3 representations are turning up. And the twister theory would make definite predictions about their quantum numbers, if it happened to work. The trouble with the ordinary three-twister theory is that the resonances that fit between the theory, the higher resonances. Although, as Nate said, there are some ideas on how to do that. It took the space to look, might be to make predictions about the scattered leptons. I'm saying that baryonium is definitely one that we ought to try, and it ought to work with any luck. I think it will be different from the predictions of the ordinary quantum model. What about the scattered leptons? Well, the problem is this model, generally these 48 things that we sample, is not a predictive model. Because supposing I stick a gadget up here, let's say we want the new leptons to be on the next one of the level. The trouble is that we have no idea of what quantum numbers we're working on. We don't know what. So there's no simple formula. Given that you know the electron muon and neutrino quantum numbers, there's no simple formula for what these might be, what this quantum numbers are. There's a simple formula for the quantum numbers here. That doesn't tell you anything about the quantum numbers that you want to know. It tells you something, but not the whole information about QL, E, and M. Basically, the problem is that the only non-linear formulae in terms of Z and X would do to give you a formula that would work for all these vectors, because they don't appear linear on this picture. So the model is not predictive, and that's a bad thing. Of course, it could still be right, it's just that it's not good enough to make predictions, but it would be more deeper theory. The question arises, though, whether you might be able to cook up another theory which is rather similar to this, which does make predictions. The answer is there is a very simple way to do it. Whether one can justify it is another matter. There is a multiple fact in just the ordinary theory of B groups. Very simple fact in SU2, a rather more subtle fact in other groups like SU3. Basically, with compact groups, but also a similar theory is being developed for semi-simple D groups like SU22. And the sort of thing that you get in all these things is that you have discrete symmetries turning out naturally in the analysis of the group representation. Particularly when you use complex analysis to handle the theory of the group representations. The so-called Borel-Weil-Bock theory. One of these, and extended by Schmidt, I'll just describe one of the features in the case of the simple SU2 theory. All it boils down to is that there's a symmetry whereby you could replace J by minus J minus 1, and nothing happens except, since we all know sheaf cohomology is the Schrodinger talk, the sheaf cohomology group changes. That's basically the idea. So when you do SU2 theory using complex analysis, what it turns up naturally, every representation naturally turns up twice, not just once, but twice. And you can draw a little diagram, one-dimensional diagram, with a point in the middle. This is the point of J is minus a half. And that has rather little physical content, but rather interesting mathematical content, which I don't want to go into. J minus a half, you can't really say it when you round it. Well, nobody seems to think that those things make any sense. It's a trivial SU2 representation, to mention zero. More interesting perhaps is J equals zero.
Dimension one.
Which is dimension one. Also pretty trivial SU2 representation. But SU1, the trivial representation doesn't just turn up the value zero, it also turns up a value J is minus one. I'm trying to plot the value of J. It's nothing to do with day three, right? Nothing to do with the entire. The eigenvalues of the SU3 quantum, the SU2 rotation. It's capital. The way the representation time theory comes out is that this thing turns out actually the same time as that. Similarly, it goes on, you got spin on R. And actually comes up at the same time as 93.2. As far as abstract group representations are concerned, these things are identical. They're the same representation. But they turn actually twice. But from the point of view of cohomology theory, these things are being zeros. Basically, on the real sphere, these things are quantum. The coefficients are sort of holomorphic line boxes. The kind of one-dimensional Yang-Mills theory. Okay, the idea is that this is actually what happens in physics, too. This is the hope. Now, there is some independent evidence that this might be a useful thing in the Hadron theory. But I just want to try and use it in the case of leptons. What I'm going to say is that the relation between an electron and a muon, which is this problem of electron-muon universality, is basically the relation between J and minus J minus 1. In other words, the electron can spin a half, let's say, and the muon doesn't have to spin a half like over a case does, but has to spin minus 3 halves. The point about spin minus 3 halves is that the formula for the eigenvalue of J squared is J into J plus 1. And if J is minus 3 halves, you still get 3 quarters by times H squared. So that 3/4 just as you would in the case of a plus r. So nothing very much changes the piece of wonder. But eventually you'll begin to see some kind of effect that you can somehow pin something on the muon which reveals the fact that it's spin is minus 3 half. But from the point of view of twister theory, it has to do with the cohomology of the twister wave function that you use to describe the system. Fortunately, we don't have a detailed theory of that, so this is just speculative from the point of view of twister theory. I don't know if you noticed, I didn't mention the wave functions during the talk. It was basically, up till now, it's just basically operator analysis. What I'm trying to say is that there's extra information in the wave function, which isn't revealed itself at the first level of just trivial operator analysis, which is essentially an abstract. I'm trying to deal with a concrete realization of an abstract problem. So the claim is that when the whole theory is known, the spin of the muon will turn out to be minus 3 halves. Well, if that's true, what does it do? Well, what it does is convert the two-dimensional into a three-dimensional picture, because I basically assumed that the overall plane eigenvalue was a half all the way through. So what you get after you've done, well, basically, if you allow the fact that the spin is minus 3 halves of the muon, you get back this cube. So what we have here, distinguishing that is a genuine three-dimensional picture again. And the really non-trivial thing is that we still have the x and zx in the degree of this way. But we have this extra degree of freedom that the j-axis is the vertical axis. So this space of the cube is now distinguished from this space of the cube by the fact that this is the eigenvalue j plus a half, and this is the eigenvalue j minus 3 halves. And of course the center of the cube is j is minus a half. Okay, so what happens if you make that assumption? Let's just do it. Well, the first thing is that for every lambda that we had before, we now get two lambdas. One corresponding to j in the half representation, say, one to minus 3 half. So this picture here is actually only a small part of a rather infinite picture, where we expand this ladder that way, and similarly we expand the other ladder underneath. Now the next thing is that because this I've decided that this spin flipping is related with the concept of electron muon universality. So one particular assignment of electron versus muon in this picture has to be that if I put the electron there, say, then the muon has to go underneath. So let's put the electron there, the muon there. This is assuming that I put the electron neutrino there. So in other words, I'm assuming a Weinberg's lump type double. So that will be a hypothesis, completely unknown. And this is also. And now, because we've got these two systems of ladders, we have an extended concept of electron muon universality. And for every new electron, let's look at the next run of the ladder. For every new electron that we have, we just have two of them. We have to have the corresponding muon pi. This would be what you might consider to be an electron type gadget, and then this other one would be a muon type gadget. So the concept of electron universality would extend to a concept applying to the whole setup. But it wouldn't extend to a concept of triality, like, for instance, this, one of the ideas of heavy electrons, where you have T, E, and mu, all that equal footing. Okay. So the next thing is, what about quantum? Well, everything is now linear in the picture, and we can just work out all these key quantum numbers. It just did. You just get simple linear formulas of quantum numbers. The only thing not trivial is the J formula. The J actually is explicitly in the So using those formulas, which is just around the picture, they're just the only linear rules which would agree with this picture, you can then predict the quantum numbers of these new things. And the idea would be that the new heavy lepton, if it indeed it is an lepton, that if it has spin a half, or J squared equals 3/4, the effect goes in one of these new slots, or in one of the other slots, possibly. But you soon see that because the charge is linear, let me just put in the other particles here. E plus here, and mu plus here, sorry, mu plus there, and E plus here, and mu bar U here, and mu bar mu here. If you put in the other particles, the charge is linear in this picture. So you have plus charge there, zero charge in this space, this diagonal face here, minus charge here. So the plane of minus charge, minus one charge, goes through these two points, don't you? These other points here, and down here, we have different charges from minus one. So there are only two unoccupied slots for a particle of negative charge. That means you can say very definite things. If you assume that one of them is the tau, you can say one very definite thing about the tau. You just look at these slots, it's either this slot or this slot, and write down the corresponding quantum numbers. Well, if one of the formulae there tells you that the electron number is the sum of the x eigenvalue and the z eigenvalue. But in either of these, the sum is 3. So the basic prediction of this model is that the heavy lepton, 4 minus, has lepton number 3. And that's the prediction that if this model was true, it would have to be correct. There are various consequences which come out of that. This is not the usual prediction. Most people say that the lepton number has lepton number 1. So one of these theories is right. Presumably the other theory is probably right. But it's worth at least bearing this one in mind. Because the thing is, once you've got a theory, as soon as it's disproved, you can do something else. And that's basically what people like Weinberg and Salam do. As soon as parity violation in atoms doesn't show up, you have a new theory to do it. If parity violation does show up and they do a better experiment, that new theory will be abandoned. So, every theory has some freedom in it. This seems to have very little. But obviously you would say, well, this idea of spin, negative spin, just doesn't work. So it's very easy to get rid of this theory if it doesn't work. It's still easy without another theory for the moment.